Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Who's in the movies this month? The Koch brothers and disturbed married couples and a singer-songwriter and washed-up producer who are making music on the streets of New York. Turns out all kinds of folks are featured in independent films playing around town this week. We're about to review a whole bunch of them, and later on this hour, we'll visit with a man who's done a lot to preserve the great American songbook. That man is Michael Feinstein. But first, movies, and back with us again, our film professor, Cynthia Haynes. Cynthia, how are you?
Fine, thank you, Steve.
And Bob Butler, who writes about movies at butlercinemascene.com. Bob, how are you?
Doing fine, thank you.
Steve Walker is away this week, and how's everybody? Cynthia, how are you doing?
Well, spent a lot of time in movie theaters, having fun.
Lots of stuff going on. Okay, let's move to a good list here, and let's start off with Citizen Koch. This is a documentary, and that word has quote marks around it, supposedly about the political influence of the Koch brothers, Cynthia.
No, that's me.
It's Bob.
Yeah. No. This is the film that a PBS station was putting on, then they yanked the cord on it. The left-wing conspirosphere claimed that it was because one of the famous Wichita Koch brother billionaires, David, gave so much money to PBS that PBS, collapsed.
Ah.
Caved in.
Gave up.
Well, the film was finished, apparently, on the with the filmmakers found other ways to get it finished. And by the way, they're going to be on
Central Standard next Tuesday.
That's right, 10 o'clock, the two directors, you bet.
They are Tia Lesson and Carl Diehl. They had a Oscar-nominated documentary about Katrina, the hurricane, called Trouble the Waters a few years back. I watched this film, and I'm going to tell you, I am politically in agreement with it and aesthetically madder than hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore.
Because
this is a typical, this is what documentaries have become. The idea
with
of
quotes.
With quotes. Yes. The idea of any sort of objectivity goes out the window. This is not a search for the truth. These films we're seeing now, the filmmakers know the truth before they start examining it, and you feel like the whole thing is jury-rigged to come to their preordained conclusion.
And that's happened. Why, Bob? What's going on?
Well, I think we can start by blaming Michael Moore.
Moore.
But here's the thing. Michael Moore's films are biased and prejudiced, but they don't pretend to be anything but. He's front and center. He's saying, this is how I feel about it. And that's one way of handling it.
And good for him.
These films that we're talking about here, including one that Cindy is going to be talking about in a minute, aspire to, what do you want to call it, the mask of objectivity? Yeah. But you know something's wrong whenever certain figures show up and music from Jaws starts playing in the background.
Oh,
you know,
wow.
That sort of thing. These
wow.
ominous rumbling strings tell us that these Tea Party people are bad folk.
I don't like that.
I don't like it either. It really hacks me off. By the way, this is bait and switch. The Koch brothers, they are not the subject of this. By virtue of having a ton of money, they have been able to take advantage of the Citizens United Supreme Court decision that said that corporations basically have the political rights of individuals,
mm-hmm.
pour tons of money into places like Wisconsin, where Scott Walker has got a fairly radical right agenda going.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the film follows. Now, if they had found a way to present that that struck me as being at least reasonably even-handed, I'd go, yay, guys, go for it. But as it is, I'm turned off by the obvious bias built into it, even though I agree with the bias.
Mm-hmm. Now, Cynthia, you've seen this film.
Yes, and I'm not here to defend the Koch brothers. I think if you would ask the average citizen who they are and what they do, I mean, these are guys with horns on their heads who are corrupting the political system in the United States. In fact, they're libertarians. They're against big government, more mm-hmm. government. They're against taxes. So there's a point of view that's taken from the very beginning that really will turn a lot of people off. Now, I am going to say, much as I'm going to defend America, imagine the world without her or not, everyone should see this movie, regardless of your political leanings, so in fact, you understand where maybe the other side is coming from. There's value in that. And you can sit there and be infuriated, or you can sit there and watch it and say, this is the best documentary I've ever seen, and the truth's being told. Bob?
I kind of take it as a take-your-medicine-kids kind of approach.
Mm-hmm.
One reason, perhaps, that the PBS bunch pulled out is that they saw the footage and decided that this was kind of a mess.
Well, I agree. I mean, if the decision were mine, I would have canceled it. Not because I think it's David who's on the
David Koch is on. He's a big contributor.
And they're
public
saying,
television.
You know, the implication is they applied pressure to keep it off of PBS. And I would have said no because it's so unbalanced, so uneven aesthetically. It doesn't make a lot of sense.
Well, I have a hard time then buying your premise that I should go see this film if it's so out of kilter. What do you make of what Bob just said about this transformation of the documentary from something that at least tried to be objective to something that's something else entirely?
I totally agree. Michael Moore set the trend and people are following it. I'm concerned that the American public is certain aspects of it are gullible enough to accept this as truth. And I think people with the other political perspective ought to see this and say, you know, there are people who embrace this and are grateful that this film made it to local screens.
Okay, that film again is Citizen Koch. It's playing at the Tivoli, right?
Yes.
Yes, it is.
Yes.
Okay. Let's move on to sort of a companion documentary. I'm saying that very loosely. This film is America, Imagine the World Without Her. Cynthia, this is a documentary that re-visions U.S. history through reenactments.
Yes. It's also a film. I read on the internet people are just praising it to the skies and saying, you know, finally the truth is being told. I think this should give you a hint that conservative author, filmmaker, and provocateur Dinesh D'Souza, who was a former advisor to Ronald Reagan, is the man behind this film. He was also the man behind 2016, Obama's America, which after Michael Moore's film is probably the second most successful film in terms of box office of this particular genre.
You describe this film as thought-provoking propaganda by the Michael Moore of the right.
That's right, and that's who he is. The thing that his premise is, what if British forces killed General George Washington? And so he reenacts the roles of Christopher Columbus, Abraham Lincoln, Frederick Dulles, Douglas in the creation of this country. He addresses the theft of land from Native Americans and all those diseases that were brought. Well, he makes the point, in fact, these diseases were brought by foreigners from earlier times. It's not our fault. The fact that we stole land from Mexico, and his argument is, in fact, the Americans won the war with Mexico fair and square. And so the, you know, land belongs to us. So he's making a plea for the fact that America is a great country. Let's look at the positive things it's done. But it is so distorted.
That's some things we've been blamed for are misguided, at least
right,
in his
right.
point of view.
And that's the point he's trying to make. So, I was frustrated with this movie. But again, I think people of other political persuasions ought to see this film and see where radicals from this perspective are coming from and what they have to say. I really do believe that.
That film, again, is America, Imagine the World Without Her. Okay, Cynthia, let's move on to another film here, a third film. And this film is titled Third Person. Three disturbed couples contend with third persons affecting their relationships.
This is directed by Paul Haggis, who is, I think, a very talented filmmaker, who did Crash in the Valley of Elah. I was seduced by this film. I liked it immensely. I read Bob Butler's review on the internet, and it starts out, bucket of artsy fartsy.
Uh-oh.
I thought, we sat in the same theater and watched it at the same time. Haggis is trying to make the point that in any relationship, there is a third party, whether it's a child, whether it's an ex-spouse, whether it's, you know, a current lover. So he uses some of the most incredible talent, I think, in Hollywood to make this point. It's the story is told much like it's an interwoven story. It's set in Paris, Rome, and New York. We've got Liam Neeson, who plays Michael, a guy with writer's block, who's having an affair with Olivia Wilde, who was just an off-the-wall very nutty character who develops another relationship with another man, and I won't go into details there, but Adrian Brody plays a guy who steals fashion designs from Italians and sells them in America. He winds up meeting Monica, who is a Roma, also some people refer to them as gypsies, and is conned into giving her money for in order for her to get her young daughter back from...
From the Euro coyote who has smuggled her into the country.
Mm-hmm. Right. Thank you. And Mila Kunis is in it. She's a very frustrated, disturbed young woman whose ex-husband, James Franco, has banished to the hinterlands as he refuses to allow to share custody of their child together. Anyway, and Maria Bello is a lawyer in the film.
Kim Basinger's
in it.
Yeah.
And so these three stories are intercut. And I guess
you bought it.
I bought it. I really bought it. And you know, there's somewhat of a contrivance at the end in terms of bringing some of these bringing these three stories together. But these were three stories that stood on their own that I thought were pretty powerful. Unfortunately, I went to the internet also and found that there's only one other film critic who agrees with me, David Denby, and everybody else is on Bob's side.
Let's do this. Let's listen to a clip.
Sure.
And then we'll come back and get Bob's dissenting opinion here. The clip is what, Cynthia?
It is Maria Bello's character, Teresa, is a lawyer for Julia, played by Mila Kunis, and she's trying to see her young son and get custody.
This is from third person.
I spoke to the judge. He agreed to a second psychiatric assessment.
That trink hated me before he even walked in.
Well, let's make a better impression this time because his statement was really damaging.
But did anyone even look at the report? Come on, it was an accident. How many kids have died because of dry cleaning bags? I saved his life.
Julia, you failed the lie detector test.
I'm the one that insisted on doing it.
And I told you it was a bad idea.
Why, you have to understand.
No, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Right now, we just need to convince the judge that you're stable enough to get visitation again.
Really? What's the hurry? It's only been 12 months.
Well, you haven't really been helping yourself. Did you get a job?
I've had half a dozen jobs.
One that you keep for more than a week. We need a positive report. Gina will give you the address 4:00 tomorrow.
No, that's great. Let me ask to leave early the first week of a brand new job.
Just use that pretty smile of yours.
Again, that's from third person, and Bob Butler wasn't crazy about it. Why not?
No. The whole thing felt to me to be totally contrived.
Mm.
You know, there is a school of thought. There are those who will tell you that Paul Haggis' Crash, which won the Oscar for Best Picture a few years back, only won because the Academy was too cowardly and or homophobic to give it to Brokeback Mountain.
Yeah.
And this is the film for those who thought that they were right.
He's making his point here.
Great cast, and yet I felt nothing for anybody.
Mm-hmm.
There was a certain amount of suspense in the Brody plot because he's coming up against some thugs in Rome. But by and large, I found most of the dialogue to be kind of contrived and artificial. Actually, the conversation we just heard was one of the more realistic exchanges.
But you don't feel for anybody in this film, it doesn't sound like.
Cynthia, maybe I'm totally off base here, but I kind of felt like this film gave women a really hard time. They're either manipulative or mental cases. The Mina Kunis character, for instance, is a total mess. If I was a judge, I wouldn't let her near the kid either.
Well, you know, maybe I've been binging too much in Orange is the New Black and Fargo and, you know, in terms of characters. And they're not likable. But I thought that these were interesting stories. I wanted to know where they were going to go. And it's definitely a film for grown-ups. There's no doubt about that.
It's always interesting to me how two very thoughtful, intelligent folks can walk into the same theater at the same time and walk out with two
extraordinarily different
viewpoints of what you had just seen.
Thank God. That's why there are critics.
That's right. Again, that film is third person, a very split verdict from Cynthia Haynes and Bob Butler. Okay, let's go back to our list, and let's go to Begin Again as we review the latest art, independent, and foreign films now showing around town. Bob Butler, tell us about Begin Again. It's about a singer-songwriter and a washed-up producer who make music on the streets of New York.
How many of you remember Once? That wonderful movie from 2008 about an Irish street musician and a girl from Czechoslovakia.
And had the hit song out of it and all
that
stuff.
They won the Oscar.
Yeah.
Well, you can see it once again.
On Broadway. Yeah, it's a Broadway hit, too, in a stage version. Well, anyway, the director of that was an Irishman named John Carney. And he spent the intervening years, well, screwing up his career. He made a really bad comedy about an alien who comes to Earth. And he made a horror movie that no one has seen. So he decided to return to the well, make a movie with lots of live music, a love story, kinda. The setup here is that Keira Knightley plays a young woman who has come to the United States with her pop star boyfriend, played by Adam Levine of Maroon 5 and, of course, the TV show The Voice. He cheats on her, and she's getting ready to leave. That night, a friend invites her to play at an open mic night, and she's overheard by this boozy, broken-down record producer played by Mark Ruffalo. He is transformed.
I always liked that guy.
He sees in this woman something he can mold, and he comes up with this idea to record an album for her on the cheap, recording it on little laptop computers in the streets and rooftops of New York. So you're hearing police sirens and kids playing, which is actually a pretty neat idea. This is sort of a kids, let's put on a show movie. And at the same time, there's a little bit of a love story, but I don't want to press that because it isn't a typical romance. He's got 20 years on her, and he has an ex-wife and a teenage daughter. By the way, the ex-wife is played by Catherine Keener, and the daughter is played by Hailee Steinfeld.
And they're terrific.
And they are fantastic.
They're really good in it.
I found this to be a hugely enjoyable movie. It is not in Once territory because it doesn't have the songs of Glenn Hansard this time around, but I found it very, very enjoyable.
Huh.
Yeah.
Cynthia?
And I tend to agree with them. It's a film about authenticity. There were just too many echoes from Once. And my problem was with the inauthentic Keira Knightley. Yes, I know she performed her own songs in the film. But, I mean, give me a Joni Mitchell, a Judy Collins, or a Joan Baez any day. I mean, I just sort of thought that the music was just too sweet and too bland at the same time.
There is kind of do you remember in Once, the scene where the boy and the girl go to a music store during lunch hour? Mm-hmm. He starts playing his song on the guitar. She picks it up on piano, and it, of course, won the Oscar, that song they're singing.
Yeah.
There's something a little magical like that in this. While the girl's up on stage playing, and the rest of the room, the people are bored, they're talking, they're drinking, the Mark Ruffalo character is frozen, and he imagines how he would produce this song. And a drum kit at the back of the stage starts playing itself.
Yeah.
A bow lifts off and starts strumming a cello.
Wow.
It's like Fantasia.
It is like Fantasia. And we have a clip. This is him approaching her after he has heard her play, and he has imposed upon that performance his own production imagination.
From Begin Again.
Your song's good. It's you. Standing up there like a tomboy, and I don't mean to be offensive, but don't you think that looks a little passe?
Really?
Seriously, we get you a look and a killer video, and you go straight to the top. I'm thinking Norah Jones, singer-songwriter thing at a piano, or the Cardigans. Back in the day when they first came to America, maybe even Deborah Harry. A male band behind you. What? You find that amusing?
No, I'm sorry. Something went down the wrong way. Whoa. Sorry? No, you were saying? Me with a cardigan on, Norah Jones?
Hey, babe, who do you think you are? What, are you going to stand up on a stage with a beat-up guitar and you think you're the new Carole King?
No, I just think that an A&R man telling an artist how they should dress or come across is total bull. People don't want that. They want authenticity.
Okay, babe.
Okay.
If they
babe.
Could get Adam Levine to, and I think he did a credible job.
He did a good job.
He really
yeah.
did. They should have gotten someone like Norah Jones, for goodness sakes. I mean, mm-hmm. Keira Knightley just put me off.
Well, I'm a Keira fan, so there you go.
So that's sort of a mixed review here for Begin Again, if I'm hearing you two correctly.
Yes. Don't expect the world, but enjoy yourself.
Yeah, I keep waiting for a film that I want to spend my weekend with, and so far we're 25 minutes in. I have not heard it yet. I'm still waiting here. Let's see if we find it.
A Hard Day's Night.
Yeah, there you go. Let's see if we find it as we move along here. Our next film today, Obvious Child, Bob Butler. It's about an aspiring stand-up comic who comes to terms with an unwanted pregnancy and her decision to terminate it.
This, I'm tempted to call this a brave film because almost invariably in modern movies, if a woman is faced with an unwanted pregnancy, she finds a way to go through with the pregnancy.
Juno?
Always, yeah. And this is about a young...
obnoxious?
Dirty-mouthed, young, aspiring comedian who gets drunk, has a one-night stand with a cute and actually very nice guy, finds herself pregnant, and isn't quite sure what to do. Jenny Slate stars. She used to be, for one or maybe two seasons, in the Saturday Night Live cast. She has several TV credits. I thought she was really terrific in a dramatic role. And what surprised me about this film, and it's made by a woman named Gillian Robespierre. Forget French Revolution jokes here.
Debut. Yeah.
Yeah. It's her first time out. She did a really credible job. And what I like about this film is that while it's got funny stuff, it was the serious parts of it that really grabbed me. And I did not expect that.
I didn't expect what I watched either. I was of the impression that it was referred to as the abortion comedy. And I just was very reluctant. I'm also definitely not a fan of the Sarah Silverman school of humor.
And that's definitely what you're getting.
And
here.
That's what you're getting with her stand-up.
Which is what?
Foul-mouthed.
Very dark, black, sense of humor.
And offensive to me. Let me just put it that way. And I was really surprised by her performance. I mean, it did start up with her stand-up routine. I thought, oh, my gosh, I'm going to have to sit here through an hour and a half. But she followed a path here that convinced you that this really was an agonizing decision that she was going to make.
This wasn't a rah-rah.
Jenny Slate you're talking
about.
Yeah. Yeah.
This wasn't a political movie
in any way, shape, or form.
It wasn't about, you know, women's rights and all that. It's about an individual, which when you come right down to it, is always what it's about. What is one woman going to do?
Mm-hmm. Okay. So anyway, I wound up being very impressed by the finished product. I mean, don't be put off by the first half hour. I mean, stick with it, and there's a story to be told in it. I think it was told well.
Okay. That movie, again, is Obvious Child. All right. Let's do this. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our good conversation about the latest art, independent, and foreign films now showing. We'll get to The Love Punch. We'll turn to Words and Pictures and several others. And later on this hour, Michael Feinstein joins us. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're visiting with Bob Butler, Cynthia Haynes. We're talking about the latest art, independent, and foreign films now showing. And we're moving on here to a film, Cynthia Haynes. Its title is The Love Punch. It's about a divorced couple who reunites after their pension is stolen.
I'd like to preface my comments by saying that both Love Punch and Words and Pictures have a very strong audience out there. They've been around for almost a month now. So there are a lot of people who want to see it. So I want to say that up front. I was disappointed with both of the movies.
Mm.
A sleazy corporate raider has raided the pension funds of the employees of a company that's run by Pierce Brosnan. He and his ex-wife, Emma Thompson, then team up to steal their money back. And I'd really put it in the silly romantic caper category. It's not offensive in the least. If you're looking to get in out of the heat and you're over the age of 60, I think you'll very definitely relate to some of the jokes that have to do with eyeglasses and bodily functions. But
at least it's set in the French Riviera.
At least it's set, and the scenery is absolutely beautiful. And there are a few 007 in-jokes that Pierce Brosnan makes in the film. The duo and their friends, Jerry, he's played by Timothy Spall, and Penelope, played by Celia Imrie, they're both British actors, all decide to show up at the bad guy's wedding to a supermodel to steal something back to, you know, regain their pensions. And I was so put off again by this overdone parody of Texans.
Mm.
And so they dress up like Texans, wear cowboy hats, they're loud, the women are, you know, totally brassy.
Yeah.
And anyway. And that's it. I mean, that's the extent of it. Thank you, Bob. But I miss the Cary Grants and the Gregory Pecks and the Audrey Hepburns and the Tracy and Hepburns who did this sort of romantic comedy so much better.
What's the clip we have from The Love Punch?
We have Pierce and Emma. Of course, these are adults who need to rely on their kids in order to access information on the internet.
Okay.
Okay, what do we know about these guys?
Oh, well, they came in hard and fast out of nowhere. The holding company traded by the name of Lexon. We were persuaded to integrate our pension fund into theirs. Turns out Lexon was hollow, toxic. So when they turned to dust, so did our pension. There's always something bigger behind these things. Someone who manages to wipe their hands clean and move on.
Still allergic to cat hair?
Worse than ever.
Go on, Harpy, sit on him.
So you got your PhD?
Yeah.
So how's life as a lecturer?
Underpaid.
Well, the students like.
Undermotivated. Could you just stop fidgeting and sit down? I'm on the site, but I can't get any real info. I'm being blocked. We need a password. We need...
Matt.
We need Matt.
Mom, you do know hacking is illegal.
I know, Matt, and I would never want you to do anything illegal, but I wondered if you could just accidentally stumble into it.
You know, that's what Pierce Brosnan does, right? The quick, witty repartee Okay, yeah, okay. But you weren't knocked out by it. That's The Love Punch, right?
Correct.
Okay. Words and Pictures, Cynthia. It's a romantic comedy about prep school English and art teachers who wage war.
It was directed by Fred Shepsey, who did Six Degrees of Separation, some other pretty good films.
Some great Australian movies back in the day.
Yes, I agree. Juliette Binoche plays Dina Del Santo, an art teacher with rheumatoid arthritis, which is it's a very interesting twist to the story that adds a whole other dimension that I think has value in telling this kind of story. But her contention is words are lies, pictures are truth. She's self-centered, she's aloof. Clive Owen plays Jack Marcus, an alcoholic English teacher who teaches at the same Northeastern prep school. And he's tough and arrogant, but loved by his students, and his job is in jeopardy because the guy, you know, drinks too much. And so you know exactly where this so-called witty banter is going to lead them. But before they get there, they engage their students in a debate about whether words or pictures have the most power.
And of course, the kids are galvanized. They begin writing poems and painting murals. And what high school is this? The other thing is that the depictions of the kids in this, I hated the little buggers. Little creeps in blue blazers. Holy cow!
Wow, that set him off.
Yeah, okay.
Well, anyway, but like I said earlier, there's an audience for this. It's not offensive. And if you're not going to Terminator, or what is it? Transformers
or the Planet of the Apes.
Planet of the Apes. You want to get out of the heat?
You know, it's interesting. This movie is to me the very definition of middle brow. It wants you to come out feeling like you've really learned something without really having taken you anywhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What's the clip from Words and Pictures, Cynthia?
I think it's kind of this flirting back and forth between the two characters.
All right.
Oh my God, Del Santo, you should see something. You should see how you look in that line.
For God's sake.
I wish I was a painter.
Words fail.
Pictures, too. I can't tell you how much I want us to put our mouths together.
Oh, really? You're attracted to me?
Very much.
Why?
Same species, different sex. Aren't you attracted to me?
Not in the least. Did you think I would be?
Well, I had high hopes for this jacket. I mean, it's old, but it's custom made, and yet you feel nothing?
Admiration.
Good.
For you, Taylor.
God, you're fantastic.
You're such an ass.
You have such an ass.
Oh, you know nothing about my ass.
Excuse me, I've studied its dimensions for months. Del Santo, I am going to walk over there where the light is falling on you, and I am going to kiss you. Unless you speak a loud, resounding no.
Okay.
Like every teacher I've ever had.
The clip had to end there, didn't it? Yeah. Okay.
And here are two actors of incredible talent, I think, playing parts, roles that are somewhat beneath them.
All right. How about some things coming up that movie folks might be interested in going to check out?
Well, one of the things we don't do on this program is review films before they open locally, but we won't be on for another 3 or 4 weeks. And there is a documentary that's making the rounds. People are saying that it's a shoe-in for a nomination for an Oscar. And this is a documentary about film critic Roger Ebert.
And how appropriate that would be if it was nominated for an Oscar.
It's called Life Itself. As Roger Ebert hit his wife, Chaz, they invited Steve James, the director of the documentary Hoop Games.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Dreams.
Or Dreams, right.
A
film that Ebert and his late partner, Gene Siskel, championed on their television show.
I remember.
They invited him to come and make a documentary about Roger. What he didn't realize is that Roger wouldn't live more than 3 months. Most of the new footage in this is of Roger in the hospital and the indignities that the cancer Roger had heaped upon this guy were pretty grueling. My wife said she loved the movie, but she didn't think she could ever see it again because she just found that too sad and disturbing. Now, Roger Ebert had an ego that would inflate like a gas to fill all available space. And this film, I believe, is about that ego and how in his latter years, through marriage and inheriting a family of step-grandchildren, Roger Ebert became a nice guy. So it's a warts and all documentary. And I found it to be not only a really interesting story about a guy who basically redefined what criticism means for people all over the world, but about a human being and what the changes he went through.
How did he redefine criticism?
We're in a whole new world right now. I mean, we're very fortunate, Bob and Steve and I, to be able to talk movies on the radio like this. But people are getting their information from the internet, from blogs, and they're no longer individuals who are out there who are the lone voices giving us opinions about movies.
Like Siskel and Ebert
like
once
Siskel
were.
And
so they were forerunners.
They dominated the conversation for 20 years.
Yeah. So we wanted to give people a heads up. It opens next week, I believe, at the Tivoli.
But it's a hard film to watch. Am I hearing that right?
You know what? Bob? It is uproariously funny in part. Some of the memories of his old barfly pals about the young Roger when he was at he'd work at the Chicago Sun-Times until 1 a.m. and then party until the bars closed at 6.
Wow.
Ebert's wife, Chaz, is really the force behind having made this film. And she, Ebert kept making the point that he wanted to show what it was like and not to be afraid of death. And he was frustrated that Gene Siskel, who died of cancer
About 10 years earlier,
kept it a secret. And he said, you know, why? And so that was the reason we see so much of him in this hospital bed. There were certain scenes she did not want the filmmaker to shoot. He went ahead and shot them anyway when she was out of the room, and they wound up including him in the film. So those are some of the films that scenes Ellen
There's a really funny moment when Gene Siskel's widow recalls the time she was 7 months pregnant and Roger Ebert stole a cab from her.
What do you learn about the relationship between Siskel and Ebert? I've read so much over the years, different things.
There was real animosity.
Especially at the beginning. They didn't talk to each other. They went to screenings for years, but since they worked for rival papers, they barely said a word. And when they were thrown together, someone described Siskel as a rogue planet that Roger could not control, and it drove him nuts.
Huh.
And it was also a class difference, too. I mean, Ebert wasn't as educated as Siskel and didn't have that world of culture that he didn't come from that the way.
There's a great moment in there. Roger Ebert, you may know, wrote the Russ Meyers sexploitation movie Beyond the Valley of the Dolls back in the 60s.
Yeah.
Now, Gene, I did not know this. Gene Siskel, for several years when he was a young man, was part of Hugh Hefner's retinue. There are pictures of him in a hot tub with naked girls. And as one of their mutual friends said, Roger wrote Beyond the Valley of the Dolls. Gene lived it.
Wow.
Pretty neat, huh?
Yeah. Yeah. Different experiences altogether. What else is happening at the Tivoli coming up here in the next few weeks? Cynthia?
Yes. They're doing some wonderful programming, showing some National Theater live plays. at the theater. The Nant, starring Nathan Lane, is going to be shown July 14th, which is a Monday at 7 p.m., July 19th, Saturday at 1:30. National Theater Lives, A Small Family Business, will be shown on their screens Wednesday, July 16th, and Sunday, July 20th.
Okay. Also coming up is a film, Chinese Puzzle. It's the third of a French trilogy about a 40-ish or so writer who moves from Paris to New York City to follow his ex-wife and their kids.
It's the follow-up to L'Auberge Espagnole, which was about a bunch of international college mm-hmm. students in a Barcelona hostel, basically. And this is a little bit like the 7-Up movies or Before Midnight, Before Sunrise movies. They follow the same characters over various courses of their lives, and they periodically drop in on them. If you've seen the other movies, it's really neat to see the actors, how they age and mature.
And that opens at the Tivoli July 18th.
Then there's Venus and Fur at the Tivoli. It's a film adaptation of David Ives, a Broadway hit about the director of a play and the mysterious woman who arrives for an audition. Directed by Roman Polanski.
And starring his wife.
Yes, who is really quite good in it.
Yes, I agree. And that opens on the 18th. And then Boyhood at the Fine Arts, August the 1st. This is one everybody's talking about, following a kid for 12 years.
Yep. Yeah, it's like Richard Linklater made a fictional film. His leading man, he started shooting him when he was 7. And he kept shooting him every year for 12 years.
Filming him,
yeah. Yeah, right. And Ethan Hawke and one of the Arquettes. Which Arquette?
Patricia
Arquette play the parents. And they, of course, are growing old, too. So it's a fantastic experiment.
So if there was one film you were going to go see this weekend that falls into the category of sort of art, independent, and foreign, Bob Butler, it would be what?
Well, I'm going to go back a month and say, go see Ida or Ida. Polish movie that has just knocked me out and still does. Yeah.
I agree with Bob, but also add A Hard Day's Night. Mm. The Beatles.
The Beatles new
remastered.
Film. Okay, sounds great. Thanks to Bob Butler. Always good to have you here. ButlerCinemaScene.com. Cynthia Haynes, the great film professor. Thank you very much for coming in, guys.